$2,000 per day. So well done for that. And hopefully in the process that if you're the organizer or helping out, that you've learned something about Buddhism, the Dharma in the process. And you're a visitor, you've been inspired, you've learned a little bit more stuff that you didn't used to know in the process. And I'm sure that there are also videos and pictures and things like that that other people can benefit from it too. So really, really nice, fantastic work there. Actually, as a out of curiosity, how many of you here are new to Buddhism or relatively familiar, just kind of dabbling a little bit, or quite familiar, you've kind of been exploring it, reading it for a number of years, you've kind of delved into it. So there are three options here. How many of you here are new to Buddhism? Okay. Yep. Somewhat familiar, dabbling a little bit. Okay. And quite a number of years, you've kind of been studying it, exploring it a little bit more. All right, great. All right. And some can't quite decide. That's fine. That's why I gave three rather than two. So, all right. So we do have a fair bit of a mix this evening, so I'll see how I go. The topic for this evening is, one is one's own refuge. As Buddhists, who do we really rely on? Well, actually, as Buddhists, who do we need to rely on? Please see the other board. One is one's own refuge. Really, that's the answer. However, let's spend a little bit more time on it this evening. When Tusk gave me this topic, one of the things he raised was there's some, is it a contradiction or some confusion around, on the one hand, you hear in the scriptures being said that one is one's own refuge. This is actually something that the Buddha has been recorded to have said, one is one's own refuge. At the same time, we take refuge to the Triple Gems, the Buddha, which is the founder, the Dharma, the actual teachings itself, the Sangha, which is a community that have practiced really well based on the teachings of the Buddha. And these are what we traditionally call the Triple Gems. And taking refuge in the Triple Gems is like a declaration that you want to follow the Buddha's path. And that's such a key aspect of being a Buddhist. So how do you reconcile that? And how do you reconcile that with some of the Buddhist practices that we see whereby people go to Buddhist temples and they pray for certain things, ask for certain protection and this and that, or you can see protective charms, pendants, holy water and the whole gamut. How do you actually reconcile those different bits? And this is an interesting question, because Buddhism has been with us. The Buddha, the historical Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama, he's died over 2,500 years ago. Depending on which calendar, which scholar work that you look at, it's probably closer to about 2,600 years. So that's a fair bit of chunk of time since that he's died. And he's practiced a lot. He gained enlightenment and he taught the path, which is what we call Dharma, his teachings. That's the second of the Triple Gems. So the Buddha, the Dharma, and as he taught, different people practice, and as they practice, they also gain realizations and what we call enlightenment or liberation. And that is the what we call the Sangha, the third part of the Triple Gem, which is the community that who have well practiced. So it's quite some time now since the historical Buddha. So a lot of things have evolved and changed. And I'll touch upon this in a little bit, which starts to help us reconcile what the different points and what the different changes that that Buddhism has evolved and gone through. And how do we then reconcile the different message? It might be useful for me to tell you a bit of my personal journey with Buddhist practice or with Buddhism. I grew up in a traditional kind of Chinese Buddhist-y household. And what I mean by that is that you go to the temple a few times in a year during festive seasons, typically New Year, Vesak, which is actually, this is for Buddhists, this May is a big month. Vesak is where many different traditions, and most of the traditions typically celebrate the birth, the enlightenment, and also the final passing away of the Buddha in this month, which is the month of May. And this celebration is called Vesak, whereby a lot of devotees or Buddhists go to temples. So those are typically the times I go to the temple. Right? So growing up, my family really didn't know too much about Buddhism. You grew up, you kind of, this is what your your ancestors did, so you just continue on. And we are what we call Jostic Buddhists. Jostic are, any of you not know what Jostic actually means? Jostics. All right, if I describe to you, probably in incense in a stick form, what we call in Southeast Asia. You know, you got the incense whereby it's like a bit pinkish and reddish, and then the part is that you burn is the incense. Yeah. So they're incense sticks. So in Southeast Asia, it's often translated as joss sticks. I don't know why that term, but that's just how it's been called. And I grew up as a Jostic Buddhist, which means that's as much Buddhism that I knew. I'll go in front of a statue that I've been told is very powerful, right? And then you take these joss sticks, and it has to be one, or three, or five, no one knows why, right? It's like, why? Don't ask too much, just take the joss sticks, and go in front of the altar, and then you say your name, me, Chen Hongguri, and you say your date of birth, where you live, just in case you got the wrong person, right? Name, date of birth, and your address, and then you say, may you protect me from certain things, or may certain wish come true. So those are typically what we call, and there's still a lot of that in Asian countries, what we call Jostic Buddhists, who are traditional Buddhists. They don't really know much of a concept about what's behind the teaching, but they follow the rites and rituals around that. How many of you know what I'm talking about? Kind of came from that background. Okay, all right, so, yes.
Who is that referring to?
Yes, that's a very good question. It depends on which temple or which center you go to. Some centers, which are Buddhist centers, you'll see you have a Buddha's image, typically in the center or the main hall. And then left, right, front, or back, then there are different deities, right? And depends on the tradition, some will call them bodhisattvas, whereby they are Buddhas to be, they're in training, they're kind of moving their way towards Buddhahood, right? And some centers, then you have the Buddha and all his disciples. You see that they're more monk-like rather than human-like. They've got shaven heads. Those are typically, like, during the time of the Buddha, his right and left-hand men, Sariputta, Moggallana, and all his various different disciples. So typically, that is the type of Buddhist temples that one goes to. That's where they so-called pray to. And then you also have in the Chinese traditions whereby they have incorporated the different gods and deities within the local culture. This is pre-Buddhist times, right? And they have actually incorporated various types of, in English translation, it's like our equivalent of angels and deities that you'll see that they have in different forms, typically carrying different things, and typically carrying different weapons, right? Big swords or like huge fans or something like that. Right? So these are like the deities or the what they call those beings in the Deva realms. So these are usually the ones that the Buddhists or the Jostic Buddhists typically pray to. Yeah, does that answer your question?
It's a sentient supernatural entity.
Yes. The notion is that these are supernatural entities that is able to grant wishes, protection, and so on and so forth. And that's the idea behind that. So this is where sometimes the contradictions start to come out. And I'll start to weave this together in a bit. So that was my background. Right? I went with my one joystick, three joystick, five joysticks, and then you go in front, you declare your name, you state your identity, and you ask for whatever it is that you want, right? And then you hope that you get granted. And if the wish comes through, then you'll go back and thank the deity or the Buddha or whoever it is, and say that, thank you for that. This is so-and-so coming back to thank you, right? And you offer maybe money or whatever it is, or fruits, or... And in some centers, they are like milk. Milk is a very common offering. They offer milk to like the Bodhi tree or the representation of the Buddha. Now this is very, I find, traditional kind of rite or ritualistic Buddhist. Right? And many of you have come from that background, so you can relate to this. And that was the environment I grew up in. Didn't really know much, kind of just follow what my parents said. They didn't quite know much, they follow what their parents did. So it's kind of handed down that way. Then in that period of time also, apart from asking things, then you also go to temples sometimes and there are monks or there are some kind of Buddhist teachers in those centers or Buddhist representatives that they'll give you blessings, they'll give you certain pendants or certain paper to hold or certain, what they call Buddha cards, whereby, you know, you've got a nice card with a Buddha face on it, it's nicely laminated, and you'll keep with you for protection, supposedly. Yeah. So I've got heaps of that. And then beads, chanting beads, and pendants, you know, the whole lot. Right, so these are essentially symbolism, right? And if you do not understand it, it becomes very mystical, right? And your monk will say, oh, you're going out. Make sure you wear the pendant before you go. Oh, you're going overseas. I'll give you this pendant and that blessing and that protection, right? And sometimes I must say that Buddhist teachers perpetuate that too, and we'll come back to why that is the case. Right? Some of you know exactly what I'm talking about, yeah? So that's the environment I grew up in. So in fact, one of my earlier memories around Buddhism or encounter with Buddhism is firstly, teary eyes. Secondly, painful knees. And thirdly, being wet. And I'll expand that a little bit more. Teary eyes means, you know when there are like huge festive seasons and the temple is built like for like probably like 100 or 200 years ago, so it's not very big. There were not a lot of people back then, right? But it was considered a big temple back then. But 100, 200 years later, the structure is still there, not that much bigger, the hall is that big, and everyone is going with their 1, 3, or 5 joysticks, right? And you can imagine the amount of smoke that's coming out of that. So I remember as a small child going to that environment, what I could remember is essentially smelling the incense, the joystick, and my eyes were just tearing up because there was just so much smoke in there, right, from the joysticks. Right? Some of you are nodding along, probably you have that experience. The second one is painful knees, which is you kneel there, right, and then sometimes it's not very clean because there's so many people coming in and out during festive season, so you're kneeling there to have painful knees. And thirdly, feeling wet in the sense that some places they give blessings, and the way that they give blessing is using water. So you are asked to kneel in front of the statue, and then one of the people there will chant, and then they will take out some flour and dip it in water, and then they will kind of splash you. Some of you have that, you know, some of my cousins is nodding, I think, probably had a fair bit of that. And it is supposedly that the wetter you get, the better, right? The more the blessing. But if you miss the water, you're like... trying to move the wetter. Make sure you get the blessing, right? So you can see, if you don't really have much understanding of Buddhism in its core, that all seems very mystical and is very other-reliant. Yeah, and that was the environment I grew up in. Right. I grew up in Malaysia, and there, similar to many Southeast Asian countries, there's a lot of that going on. Even till today, when I go back there, I see a lot of that. Although we have evolved so much more our understanding as a society, even in Asian countries, our understanding of Buddhism. But back then, that was my background. So I started then, around high school, to delve in a little bit more. And in fact, my mom and I both started to learn about Buddhism, and it's a little bit more about what the practice is and having more interactions with monks and nuns a little bit more, asking them more questions about what you do. So then you start a practice of chanting Buddhist scriptures, you're doing your prostrations, or you have observance days whereby you, if you're not vegetarian, then you are vegetarian for 7 days of the month, things like that. So you started to take a more active form. You're not just there to kind of ask for stuff and cash in. Right, you're kind of doing a little bit of work at the same time. You kind of feel that you have to do some part on your own. So that started my early years of probably my adolescent years, starting to explore Buddhism and Dharma a little bit more. And then that went all the way to when I came over here to university, then that consolidated my growth as well. I was very fortunate to be trained in both the Theravadan school, the Burmese temples, the Burmese teachers. So I got great Burmese teachers. I also had a lot of Chinese Mahayana teachers. So these are very different forms of Buddhism. So actually, to be honest, the early parts I was pretty confused. Because you go to one temple, there are different sets of deities. And you go to another set, there are different sets of deities again. So hang on, he doesn't appear in that one. She doesn't feature here. So it's like, why is it so different? So that was the environment I grew up in. And it was only when I came over here into university, and in fact, Unibux was one of my the places whereby my understanding of Dharma really took root. Here, being exposed to various different teachers, and when they come here, they don't talk to you about those rites and ritual stuff. Right? They don't ask you to do that 1, 3, or 5 joysticks and things like that. Usually, teacher comes here, they talk about the core of the Dharma, and that's where it really consolidated and even grew a lot more from. And then later on, I also came across the teachings of how the Buddhism evolved over time. And that really makes sense to me why it is where it is today. So that's my personal journey, and I'm talking to you from my personal journey in the process of being a very outwardly focused Buddhist, right? Whereby everything is kind of deities out there, like the statue has power that can grant me stuff, to practicing and understanding what the core of it. And the core of the Buddhist teaching is, in fact, this. One is one's own refuge. Buddhism in its core emphasizes the importance of the cultivation, right? The development of oneself. And that is the core of the teaching. The development of the factor of wisdom. And there's a path towards that, which is the Eightfold Path. Essentially, it's a set of training to actually train oneself to develop wisdom. And really, when you unpack wisdom, wisdom simply means to really see things clearly. To gain the right understanding of how you see the world. If you really understand Buddhism, it is not about something that is given to you externally, but it is about how you change your view about life, about the world. Right? And that is what is encapsulated as right view. The right view of the world, that is which liberates you. To be able to see things clearly, then you would have less fear, less difficulties, less suffering, and less pain. Right? That is the heart of it. That you need to do the work. In fact, other people's realization is other people's realization. The Buddha's realization is very good because he, through his own practice and investigating and observing phenomena internally and externally, he came to realization. That was what we call his enlightenment. He was enlightened or awakened to the realities of life. He's able to change the view that he had about the world and therefore break through the pain and suffering. And because of that, he cannot say that I therefore bestow upon you my realization. He could not do that. As much as his compassion was, he couldn't say that which I realized, I give to you. It is like if... How many of you have tasted durian before? Alright, great. How many of you have not tasted durian before? Durian, that's a fruit. Okay. If you haven't heard of it, you probably haven't tasted it. You have smelled it? Yep. Have you tasted it? Okay, alright. So there are two groups of people here. Someone who has tasted it, and someone who haven't, but maybe has smelled it. Now, however skillful those who have actually tasted it, however rich your vocabulary is, and your ability to paint the picture of what the taste is like, and if you were to tell a person who has never tasted durian before how it tastes like, you might be able to get to some degree of quite close to the experience. You might be able to say, well, you haven't tasted durian, maybe like cheese, you know, a creaminess, or blue cheese, you know, depending on the type of the durian. So you might be able to use those to actually imply what it means, right? But you're not able to convey the actual flavor until the other person picks up a piece of durian, for better or for worse, and put it in their mouth, right? And they'll go, this is durian. Right? And then, depending on their affinity with the durian, they might love it or not like it, right? So to some, it's like a bomb or gas leaking, like leaking gas as a smell. Some people, it's like, whoa, it's like, heavenly flavor, right? But you cannot convey it to another person to its fullest. You can't point it too close to it, but you will still not be able to fully convey that. And that's the same nature of the Buddha's realization. He realized and he saw, so this is the reality of what we call self. What, how the world is, how phenomena arises, how pain and suffering arises, what is useful to head towards peace, purity, goodness, what is it that leads us into distress, suffering, and pain? He saw it clearly. And as much as that was the understanding appeared to him, and that realization that he had woken from that, he can only say that it is a little bit like this or like that. And his ingenuity is being able to say, alright, this is how I got there. So, this is what, if you want liberation, right, and this is what you will need to do. That's why he was a very systematic teacher. Right? He was able to very systematically say, oh, this is the things that you do. You come up with this, this, this. This is how you observe reality. This is how you delve into the Buddha Dharma. This is how you learn to watch reality for what it is. He's able to do that, but the realization itself he could not impart. He could point to it. He could say that, you know, a state like this is such and such, but he in fact said that it will be different, as much as I can convey to you. So that's the nature of the Buddha's realization. So when he did realize truth and awaken, he taught. Right? But it is up to anyone who listens or come across his teachings to then put that in practice in order to then see what he actually realized. So this is the core of it. And when you look at the quotes of the Buddha in the scriptures, there are few places whereby a quote that's similar to this comes up. Right? I've looked into three key references that it comes up. One of the main ones is when before the Buddha died. He lived up to about age 80 years old. This, I'm talking about the historical Buddha. Because since his teaching, there's also a lot of so-called the different Buddhas that has been, has evolved the teaching. But when we say the historical Buddha, that's actually a person who used to live in India about 600 years ago. When the historical Buddha died he lived up to about age 80 years old. And before he died, his attendant asked him, are you going to give any advice? Well, let me read this so that I don't get his words wrong. His attendant said, have you made some statement about the order of things? Because by then, he gained a life from about age 35, that's what we have records, and he lived up to roughly about age of 80. Now, we don't know whether it's exactly 80 years old or not, but essentially it suggests that he lived to quite an old age. So for about 40 over years, he was actually teaching, and then other people are practicing based on his instructions, and they're also seeing the truth for what they are. And these are called the enlightened ones, which is what the third gem is, the gem of the Sangha. So he's gone around teaching. So he is actually over 40 years formed quite a large group and large community we practice under him. Right? They call themselves the followers of Gautama the Buddha. So before he died, around when he was going into about a few months before he died, his attendant asked him, are you going to make some statement about the order? What that meant was, are you going to say when you die, who is going to be your successor? What's going to be the plan? What's the succession plan here? Right? And in fact, the Buddha responded to Ananda saying that actually, there is no particular person I'm appointing to be the successor. He didn't say those words, but if you actually read the scripture, that was essentially what he said. He said, what does the order of monks expect of me? I have taught the Dharma, which is the teaching, Ananda, which is the attendant's name. Ananda, I've taught the Dharma, making no inner and outer. That means I have not kept anything for the inner circle versus the outer circle. I have not kept anything from you. And he says, the Tathagata, which means he refers to himself, I have not got a teacher's fist in respect to doctrine. That means I do not hold stuff in my fist to say that this is my power, this is my authority, and I'm not sharing it with you. But he was very clear. He said, I've already taught Dharma for many years. Whatever I know, I've pointed you as much as I can. I've not held anything back. There's no inner or outer teachings. Everything I know, I've given to you. And then the order... I'm just double checking. If there is anyone who thinks after I'm gone that I am now the head of the order, let him think that, but I do not think so. That means he's saying I'm not leaving any successors here. But then he went on to say, so Ananda, as the attendant, would be like, so what happens when you're gone, essentially? Because the Buddha was very clear, there's no need for a successor because everything that I've taught, I've already taught. Many of you have already graduated. That means you have reached the level of understanding as I have. Right? So you all graduated, so you rely on that, and that will continue to flow on for the years to come. I'm not appointing a single point of a successor. If anyone comes and says that I am now the successor, I am now the one who is in charge now, let them say that, but I do not think such. Right? But then he did continue to say, so, Ananda, Therefore, Ananda, you should live as islands unto yourself, being your own refuge, with no one else as your refuge. Being your own refuge, with no one else as your refuge, and with the Dharma as an island, with the Dharma as your refuge, with no other refuge. I'll repeat this part. Therefore, Ananda, you should live as islands unto yourself, being your own refuge, with no one else as your refuge, with the Dharma as an island, with the Dharma as your refuge, with no other refuge. So he's essentially saying two things here. You rely on yourself as the real protection and refuge. And you rely on the Dharma as where you go for refuge. So you'll be thinking, well, hang on. Is he saying that on yourself and no other? Are they saying Dharma? Is it one or the other or both? Right? And this is a very interesting part, I find anyway. Because actually, also depending on the translation you will see in the different scriptures, the translator, sometimes the translation, you should live as light or lamp unto yourself. Because the traditional word is Dipa. Dipa means island, right? In the traditional Pali language, Dipa means island. Dipa means light or lamp. Sounds fairly similar. So scholars sometimes translate it one way or the other. But it means the same. Be an island unto yourself, be a light or a lamp unto yourself. You get what it means, right? You need to be your own island. You need to be your own island as a refuge. You need to be your own light and lamp as your refuge. And then he goes on to say, and the Dharma is like your island, and have the Dharma be your refuge. So it means that you need to practice the Dharma as your refuge. So you need to rely on both. The Dharma itself, if you're not practicing, no refuge. There's no real strength, anything in there. But only with your practice but no real guidance from Dharma, then who knows where you end up. Therefore, you should live as islands unto yourself, being your own refuge with no one else as your refuge. With the Dharma as an island, with the Dharma as your refuge, with no other refuge. So no one else, nothing else but you and the Dharma. Remember, he's already said, I've taught you everything that I can. It's now up to you to then practice and realize for yourself. And that he is very clear. And this is a teacher who knew that he was going to die. In fact, before that, he was already unwell. He was actually quite sick. This conversation happened, if you look at the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, which is the scripture, the teaching that talks about the last few months of the Buddha's life. This conversation took place when the Buddha was actually quite unwell. But after that, he, using his strength and his mental and physical strength, concentrated on himself and then settled the body. And then he actually found out, okay, he can function a little bit more, he can travel a little bit more. And then Ananda, being the attendant, saw that he seems to be looking better, then approached him to say, oh, it's great that the Buddha is now looking better. I was in lay translation, right? A bit embarrassment. Ananda was saying, I was a bit worried, right, that you were looking not too well. But I also knew that you wouldn't just go without giving instructions about what to do about succession planning. So this was the conversation. And therefore, then the Buddha said, I am not giving any succession planning, right? No one that you're relying on apart from your own self as the island and refuge, and the Dharma as your own island and refuge. So it's saying that you don't rely on others, you don't rely on other things, but relying on your own practice of the Dharma. Now, if the Dharma is something like blessings or a gift of some sort, then it will contradict itself, but it's not. His whole teaching is a set of training. You train in this, you do that, and eventually you see, you penetrate through, and you see the real reality of life. That teaching needs to be practiced and embodied and taken into real day-to-day life practice in order for that to come alive. And when you have that understanding and that wisdom factor in you, that is when you have the truth, and that's the best refuge that you can always have. Until you get there, you rely on the Dharma as your guidance, but as you practice according to the Dharma, your realization is that which actually helps you. Was that a question?
The system of Dharma, or that you said,
yes,
that when you're practicing Dharma, I wonder if you knew that, is there any records show that that system is viewed by one people, or by a bunch of people, by a group of people, or by one?
What do you mean?
Sorry. System of practicing Dharma, that system itself.
Mm-hmm.
Is it built by Buddha himself, themselves, together?
It came from his teachings. So what we have as Buddhist scriptures right now in the modern world, if you actually put the Buddhist scriptures together, it will go from probably this end to that end of shelf of book in fine paper and with small print. As a lot, right, of scriptures. But this, all these recordings of the teachings given is ascribed to the historical Buddha. And depends on which collection. Because different schools, it actually split at different times. But it is probably as old as about 2,000 to 2,300 years ago.
That's several centuries after it happened.
That's right.
But the way you describe it in quite detail.
And that's
this, and he said that,
that's
and he
right.
said that.
Because the first few hundred years, there was a recital tradition. In India, writing... Actually, I'll come back to that. Remind me if I don't come back. Let me answer this one first, right? So all those teachings is ascribed to the historical Buddha. But also there are certain teachings whereby it is actually accumulated and collected along the way, but they couldn't quite place whether it was the Buddha himself who said that or his disciples who said that. And there are also some scriptures which is very clear that it was not the Buddha who was teaching, but it was someone else. His attendant was giving the talk. Right? His Sariputta, his right-hand person, Moggallana, his left-hand person, they were giving teachings and those were recorded too. But the bulk of it came from that time, about 2,600 years ago. Having said so, the teachings have evolved over time. And depending on how much time, I might get to that in a bit. But when we talk about the Buddha's teachings, it has is ascribed to him as the one who has given. And he has taught his close, the ones that have learned from him, they also achieve awakening, and they continue to teach. So in a way, it has come from him, but it has also flowed down from his community. Does that answer your question?
Thank you.
Yeah. So going back to that point about after the death of the Buddha, about 2,600 years ago, there was not much writing. The writing is, who uses writing at that time? There was writing at that time, but not widely used, not like what we have here, paper there everywhere, recycle bins everywhere. It's not like that. Who used paper back then?
Government.
And in fact, one quite specific area of government used a fair bit of paper. Who do you think?
Military.
Not quite military, but I can see where you're coming from. Not quite military, but something that's in fact more important than the military from a government perspective.
Finance,
sorry?
Education.
Education? So-so, right? But finance.
Historian.
Finance. It is. Writing is the area of the tax collectors. Right? You can see why it's important, right? Because there's no tax collector, there's no military, there's no education either. So in fact, it is the tax collectors that have writing. Because they have to record such and such village, how many people, what are our trade, how many rupees, not rupees back then, but you get my meaning, right? How much collected. So that is the tradition of the writing, which is government use, and in fact, tax collector, which is not exactly crash hot with the people, right? Tax collectors, back then until today, probably is never really kind of like a very nice relationship, right? You all pay your taxes, right? But sometimes some might give it up a little bit more easily than others. But back then, tax collectors, when they come, they'll be like, right? I have to give them. So that's the area of government, which is tax collector, that is where they put down into writing. So, but in the spiritual tradition, they don't write. Because the belief is that it is so precious that you should not put it down to writing, because firstly, it's not that common, secondly, it's typically used by the tax collectors, right? But more importantly, it is so precious that you need to commit to memory by heart. It is out of respect that it is committed to memory, and not in one person, but as a community. Right? So when spiritual traditions, they emerge, when centers come up, typically you live within a community. Let's say this is a community, and we come together and we remember and we recite, and it's passed down from one teacher to another, the recitation. And also once, a few times in the month, you have to come together and check whether it's all correct, right? So all of us have to recite, all right? All of us, this is the first teachings of the Buddha, all right? So we recite together. And then if there's anything that is wrong, have you ever done chanting, and then like you've got a whole group on retreat or something, you have a chanting sheet, and then you're doing a chanting, but then you miss a word, right? You're saying, Buddham saranang gacchami, I take refuge in the Buddha. Dhammam saranang gacchami, I take refuge in the Dhamma. Sangam saranang gacchami. So Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, those are the things that change in that verse. So everyone is going, Buddham saranang gacchami, and you suddenly, your mind was somewhere else. You went, Dhammam saranang. You can see the huge difference, right? Everyone is saying, Buddham saranang gacchami. There's a tune to it, but you are off tune, because you use the wrong word, so it immediately picked up. So this is a system of checks and balances through recitation. So in the first few hundred years, no one put it down in actual writing. So going back to your question, no one put it down to writing. It was in fact a few hundred years later that started to emerge, right? Probably around Sri Lanka. That was one of our earliest traces of it, when it was first committed to writing. And supposedly it's because of the decline of those who are able to recite. Because remember, in this tradition, you need a whole community to keep each other in check, right? Because if I remember incorrectly or I've got a lapse in memory, my version of teaching can be quite different from, let's say, Tassa's version. So a few times in a year, in a month, typically four times in a month, you have to come together, let's cross-check. All right, let's do the first teaching. So we both start and then, sound right. Right, no contradictions. If there are contradictions, hang on, let's stop. Oh yeah, it's this word or that. Okay, let's continue on. It requires a community in order to do this. But after a few hundred years, when the community started to decline sometimes, right, or there's just lack of that rigor, right, that was when they started to say, we better put this down in writing so that we can preserve this. Right, because sometimes there are also various different reasons, political, environmental, there are famines and things like that, whereby communities get wiped out. So it's a risk. If suddenly there's no community, I'm alone, I can't, what if I forget? Right, I'm getting old as well. So let's put it down in writing. And that was how it actually emerged, which is a few hundred years after the death of the Buddha. And that was the earliest versions of the writing. And from there, it was translated as well to and fro. Sorry.
It seems to depend on a sort of succession of these egalitarian societies to keep the stories the same. You've only got to have a few powerful leaders or charismatic shaman or something.
That's right. And that indeed did happen. We know that these days, even the earliest scriptures, like I say, if we look at the entire cabinet of Buddhist scriptures, there's a specific section that we know is probably one of the earliest. Because when we look at the Buddhist scriptures, what we do is, currently modern school, your school of Buddhism, this is all my teachings. Right, your school, there's a little bit of difference, right? This is my body of literature, this is your body of literature, passed on different countries, different geographical areas, different traditions, right? And then, if you look at different groups, but what we can find is Venn diagram, yeah? This is what the scholars have done. Based on the different intersections, there is a body of literature that suggests that given the different schools have that overlap, this suggests to be one of the earliest sources. However, the scholars also recognize that the earliest source has already perhaps undergone some changes in there. It is very interesting. Let's say, in my tradition, I have the teaching about the last days of the Buddha. Let's say we have different Buddhist traditions over a few hundred years. He's got also a version of the last days of the Buddha. When you look at that together, a lot of things are about the same, but there are also certain differences. And this is where scholars are, even until today, we are still working on trying to refine what it is. But there's a sense of a central part of the teachings that suggest that this is remnants of the earliest form of Buddhism. And right now, what we typically the teachers call, these are the core teachings of the Buddha. Everything else is like an embellishment or evolution of the Buddhist teaching. Does that answer your question?
I'm very, very skeptical about these stories lasting 300 or 400 years, but I see what you mean. You've got a big sample of different stories you can cross-reference and maybe get that.
Yeah. The interesting thing is this. If it was not organized, then you're probably right. That it's not going to be able to stay together. But what happened was, going back to the Buddha's last days, how many of you have actually read the Parinibbana Sutta? That means the last days of the Buddha, that teaching. No? Not all? Okay. A little bit? Alright. So what happened was this. The Buddha declared about 3 months before his death, he actually said, in 3 months' time, I will die. I will enter into my final death and that's it. Then there's no more rebirth for me. And during the 3 months leading up to that, he visited all the key places that he used to teach. Spoke to different people, received alms from various different people, and gave them teachings. Remember, these are important teachings. And then finally he came to a place where it's modern day Kushinaga, and he said that this is where I'll depart now. And then he actually died there. Now, after his death, when his death occurred, the news traveled far and wide, because he was a huge, a very renowned spiritual teacher of his time. So everyone knew, the kings came, the ministers came, right, and a lot of his disciples were spread all over the northern part of India. So they knew that actually he died. They probably already kind of guessed, because he was quite old at that time. And one of his main disciples, by the name of Mahakashyapa, this was one of his kind of earliest students and one of the most has a lot of authority because there's a lot of experience. So he was like the most senior one after the Buddha. So in fact, people say that if anyone, he will probably be the one who is named the successor, but Buddha didn't name anyone. So he knew that the Buddha has died in a certain village, so he was traveling with his group, about 500 monks. Now we don't know whether it's really 500, but you get the idea, right? In scriptures they say 500 means a lot. Like, you know, like, you're 501, you go. But you get the sense. He also had his huge group of who are training under him. So when he heard the death of the Buddha, he actually then traveled by foot at that time to where the Buddha's body was to pay respect. And on his way there, right, he passed various different places and he met the different communities of monks and nuns who practiced with the Buddha. And at one point, he heard someone make a statement. You know what that statement is? What is it?
The Buddha has died. I no longer have to follow his teaching. Yep. I can just do whatever I want.
Yep. Yeah. So essentially, a little bit of embellishment. Now that teacher's gone, yay. Yeah. There's no longer a need to do practice a certain way. Because there is no longer a teacher who says, you should do this, you should not do that. Mahakashyapa heard this. Right? And then he's like, wow, the Buddha has just died and this is already occurring right now. What is going to happen to these teachings in years to come? So in fact, we have a lot to thank that particular monk. Right? A lot of people were like, terrible monk, why should you should have said that? But if he didn't say that, something later wouldn't happen, which is Mahakashyapa went to pay respect to the Buddha. And then they did a cremation, everything was done. His relics were spread to different places, right? And then Mahakashyapa said, right, now that the Lord is no longer here, the Buddha is no longer here, it is important that we preserve the teachings as much as we can. So he called what we call the Buddhist the First Council, whereby he asked all the most senior disciples who have spent the longest time with the Buddha to all come together. And it was a period of about 3 to 6 months from memory, which is the First Council, which is where all of them sat down with a more very important person, which is Ananda, the attendant. Because the attendant has been following him for the longest, and he also is one of the youngest, and his memory was the sharpest. So he could remember, because day in, day out, he keeps hearing the Buddha teach, so he could actually remember, this happened this time and that time. So during the First Council, that was presided by how many people? about 500. Again, 500, you get the idea. A large group of senior disciples all came together, and there's actually still a place right now you can visit in India where the first council occurred. Right? So all 500 of them spent a few months sitting together to work out. So they asked Ananda, all right, Ananda, so you are the one with the Buddha the longest. What have you heard? So all right, during this time, he was at this place and he gave this set of teachings. Who was that? So and so. Okay, are those of them still alive? Those of them still alive, right? You were there. Is that correct? Is that what the Buddha thought at that time? Like, yeah, it's correct. All right, we pass that as the actual authentic teaching. This process took 3 to 6 months. And then during that period, after the first council, then they established what we call the first core teachings of the Buddha. Now, to be fair, we don't know what that body of literature is. We have lost that now. Because no one there was with a video camera to actually record what was actually there. But what we know is that based on that, that was the first council, there was a lot of checks and balances that happened that allowed them during the 500, in the 500, 3 to 6 months time, they cross-checked, and then what they did was, all right, different groups are set up, you remember different sets. Yeah? And that was how the oral tradition actually continued now. So you are right, in some ways, it is hard to believe that it is that someone can actually remember that much through oral tradition. But secondly, the thing that is for that is that firstly, there was this council that was actually recorded even in the history of India, in the king's records, that there is this that actually took place, but it didn't say much about the actual body. Like I say, we probably have lost what the actual core body is. But we know that that took place and that that actually happened. The other thing is that even until today, there are monks in the world, a handful, probably about 5 to 10 now left in the world, who is able to recite by memory the entire scriptures from top to finish. The size of it is about, right, 11 times the size of the Bible. They hold the Guinness Book of Record for the strongest memory in the world. There are about 5 to 10 monks still left in the world right now. It's a dying tradition. They're able to remember word for word the amount of words that's about 10 to 11 times the size of the Bible. And that's a lot. So if they could do it right now, there is suggestion that this, there is a systematic training that has actually been established for many years. It's been a living tradition for a long time. So in between the different groups specializing in different things, plus those who are able to recite word for word, and that's really very, very impressive. Since then, 2,600 years to today, there have been 6 councils in total that's been held. The first council was straight after the death of the Buddha. And then about 100 years, I think, about then the second council was held to come back again. Now everyone has scattered, let's come back, let's double check again. Do we still have consensus? Right? And if there is no consensus, let's work it out, let's discuss this. And that's the second council, third council, fourth, fifth, and then sixth council. The most recent sixth council was about, anyone know? Does anyone remember? Buddhist exhibition people? Sixth council, when was that? It was held in Burma.
Yeah, in Burma, I can't remember the year.
Roughly? 100 years ago? 50 years ago? Less than that, I think about 50 years ago. I know, probably a bit more than that. 50 to 100 years ago. That was the sixth council.
37 years ago.
Yeah. And at that council, they are still, these are the ones that they asked to then recite. So the council has a specific format. There are the different roles of the most senior ones and the ones who are able to recite everything, right? And then there's the questioner, whereby it's like the chairperson. All right, let's recite this. Let's cross-check with different types. Does everyone agree? Yes, pass, next one. And that is the checks and balance system that's actually there. So I agree that things have changed and shifted because we know that the first, what we all agree on, that is a suggestion of what was actually passed down, but we don't have that. It's like the original source is actually no longer there. It's in fact forever lost to us. But based on the cross-check of the different, the Tibetans, the Chinese, the Korean, the Thai, the Burmese, the Sri Lankan, all coming together, and we have this small little part that we all intersect, that is where it's suggestive of the material that's being passed down. Any questions so far? We've done like detours here and there, historical lessons here. This was the stuff that I started to learn after my university days, which helped me understand why the traditions are so different. Because there is a core body of teachings, but there are also expressions of it based on the different geographical area, different belief systems that is existing in certain communities. Buddhism is very good at assimilating. So when the core teachings are brought to certain places, it assimilates with whatever is consistent with this view, that which is good, it assimilates in there, and then uses that as a form of way to actually teach. Right? So that's why they're expressions of where the core is. Any questions so far? Yeah.
So these sentient supernatural entities, where is that on the
credit? Historical lesson. No, not at all. Okay. The sentient is all out here. Because the core of it is
the
very...
supernatural stuff.
Yeah. The supernatural stuff is all here. And what one of my Dharma teachers here, Jim Teo, likes to say, this is the icing. This is the real nutritious bit, the real core of the cake, and this is all the icing. He calls it all the Mickey Mouse or whatever you put on top of it. Right? And this is a sugary part. Right? But this is the heart of it. Pramana says this is the salad, this is like the salad dressing. Yeah, sorry.
No, I've heard you do that at all. But saying it's sugary, it's almost like that's good thing.
Yeah. That what?
It's good. It's sugary and not
bad. Depends how much sugar you put. Yeah?
So it's a bit sickly then.
It can be.
Okay.
Yeah. Alright, let's keep going with historical lesson a little bit. Yes?
Could you say that Theravada is more in the core then? The
supposedly they are a bit closer, right? But even then, they don't have the full version either. Because, like recently, they're doing a lot of comparison. The Theravadan school, which is mainly Sri Lanka, Burma, Thailand, those areas, they have a lot that's based on that. But their version got translated in Sri Lanka, in Pali, and then translated to Sinhalese, back to Pali, Sinhalese, back to Pali a few times. So stuff has changed there. There's another core, which is quite key in Chinese Buddhism, called the Agamas, which is a similar, you can almost see scripture for scripture comparison. It's all in old Chinese, traditional Chinese. That is probably a bit older, because what has happened in some traditions, the original teaching got kind of put aside. Lots more topping, the topping became more important. So what ended up happening is that the core teachings will say that, yes, we have this as part of our huge collection here, this particular section, don't worry too much about it, these other parts are more important. So what ended up happening is this particular section just maintained, sustained what they were. No one really used it, no one really, it was committed down in writing, but it was just left there, so it's not a living tradition. But the good thing is, it's like a time capsule, it got preserved there. So right now, as we speak, scholars are looking at in the Theravadins, that collection is called the Nikayas. There are usually four of them, typically. The long collection, the middle length collection, the connected discourses, and the numericals, the four parts of them, right? The Theravadan school. The Chinese Mahayanas have what they call the Agamas, which is like the same thing. They've got the long agama, middle agama, right? The miscellaneous agama, numericals, which is direct translation, is plus one agama, right? And then there's a fifth one, I can't remember what it's actually called. There are five key books here, there are four key books here. And if you look at the references, they are very similar. This is where they trace the heart of it. Now, this is written in traditional Chinese. This is in Pali, and now currently translated in English. So if you're looking for English-based, this is available right now. There's a project right now internationally translating the Chinese into English, because it then allows the scholars to compare the two. Venerable Sujato is one of the people doing that. Yep.
I might be wrong, but in the translation, there are five Nikayas.
Yes. Depends on whether you consider the Kudaka or not.
True, that's true.
Yeah. The Kudaka is like the miscellaneous as well. So four plus one. So, all right, to be fair, so the two collections there. And you can actually compare them. If you go to suttacentral.net, I believe, suttacentral.net, they publish these things there. Right? The only thing that they can't get access is Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation of the Pali because of copyright. They've been fighting with Wisdom for quite a number of years, asking them to please release, for the benefit of all the world, the sentient beings in the world, please release your copyright. But Wisdom said, I don't know whether that has changed, but Wisdom said, no. It's our copyright. But it's like, you can't, these are Buddha's teachings. But we funded the publication of Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation. So anyway, there's the English translation, there's the Chinese waiting to be translated into English. Now, when you compare these two, then you get a pretty good idea of a fair bit of overlap. And it's pretty consistent. And it is here that the Buddha says, one is one's own refuge. It is in fact when this actually evolved, remember 2,600 years is a very long time. If the message is this, you need to work hard, you need to train your mind, you need to see the truth for yourself. It's a bit tiring, right? It can seem that way. But it's also very empowering because it is your mind. No matter where you go, as long as you're alive, even you're buried in a coffin, right up to your face and you're alive there, what do you have? You have your body, you have your mind. Even if your body is malfunctioning, if your mind is there, this is what you have. So, no matter where you are, you have you. You have nothing else. Yeah? No matter where you are. As long as you're alive, you're alone, you're with other people, there's your body and your mind. And really, there's the five aggregates. There's the body, right? There's the feelings, the perceptions, the mental formations, and the consciousness. These are the five things that you have with you, the five aggregates. And it is relying on the five aggregates that you're able to then practice. Essentially, you've got your body and mind, and therefore allows you to practice. Therefore, the Buddha's teaching is kept in here. It needs to be practiced. This was the earliest message that the Buddha gave. Right? But over time, what has occurred is that the teachings have evolved also. And we know that this happens in all spiritual traditions in the world that claims to have a certain root or certain text that's actually there. It's not unique to Buddhism. It's just a phenomenon that occurs around the world. When something is committed to writing or in memory or whatever it is, that changes over time. Small little changes, but if you multiply that by like 2,000 years... small changes could start to seem different. And this is where what you're saying earlier on, these deities and beings, they become more featured in them. Right? Now, for some of you, this is not news, right? But for me, when I was first venturing into this understanding, more the scholarly understanding of what's actually occurring, it was quite an interesting process and also quite shocking somewhat. Because what it suggests is that Majestic Buddhism is a very diluted version of Buddhism. It has, in fact, it's so much sugar that there's not much nutrient left. It's almost already missed the point, but better than nothing. Because at least the deity there and this little boy with teary eyes holding Majestic wondering, why? Why are we doing this? And it's the why that made me go and think and dig more and then got into understanding of the heart of it. And I like the Venerable Yin Shun, who is a scholar in Chinese Buddhism. Remember Chinese Buddhism, this is a very old text. He had access to this and he was studying. He wanted to know what happened to Buddhism in India. Why did Buddhism collapse and disappear in India? So that was his question. And when he researched the historical aspect, then he found that what actually occurred was that the teachings were there for a little bit, but then eventually there's also political reasons, various reasons, because it depends on the king also. If the king favors a certain school, a certain interpretation, right, money, funds go there, that community flourishes. The other community diminishes. The next king comes, they favor that one goes up, this one comes down. So you can see it can be political in that way. We know that in early Buddhism, there are different periods. This has now become a history lesson in Buddhism. Very important. We know that during the time of the Buddha, there was one body of literature, and about 200 to 300 years later, there are some differences in opinion. right? Now, this is what we call early Buddhism. This is what scholars call early Buddhism, when there's not much disagreement, and most probably that's the core of it, yeah? But we don't know. This is around after the First Council. What happened is that there start to be splits about 300 to 500 years after the Buddha's death, and we have different collections, and there are states that there are about 18 different traditions within Buddhism, 18 different schools, right? Some sources suggest that there are 18, some suggest that there are 15 or whatever, 20 over, but the idea is there, that there are differences, slight differences in opinion in terms of what the Buddha's teachings are. So you can see that even a few hundred years after, that was when it started to shift. Right? Certain understanding, certain interpretation started to creep in. And at that point, we still don't have the actual scriptures written down yet. It was still recital. Some of these schools died off. And we do have one or two schools that were left that continue to split to different areas. Right now, what we have in writing comes from one of the branches. Who knows what differences those other branches have, right? So in all humility as a Buddhist, as much as we want to chase what the Buddha is teaching, we know the limitations as well. But there are tools that scholars and modern technologies allow us to do, which is a comparison of the scriptures. Comparative analysis, scriptural analysis. But the best that we have is even from one of the 18 different sect, right? But as it evolved as well, through time, what has happened is the core message has been added with stuff, right? And then, you get my idea, yeah? From the core, we add a little bit, we add, and it started to shift and more, right? Venerable Yinchun, who is a Buddhist scholar, said that this period of time is what we call the first principles. There are four different categories of Buddhist teachings. That's how he categorized it. The first Siddhanta. Siddhanta is like basket or category. The first one is pertaining to the teachings around the Buddha's time. We can only best guess based on the analysis there. First principle Siddhanta. What's the second Siddhanta? What's that?
The first one should be the pure, in Chinese means pure Buddhist period. And the second is like.
Similar.
Similar, yes, yeah. Similar.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, what he said is that from the first here, it has evolved and become bigger and bigger. And his analogy is, this is like milk, and this is milk added with water, with more water, with more water.
Yes.
Like, it still has milk in it, but it's diluted. So I'm here as a Jostic Buddhist. Now you can somehow trace back to a Buddha because the image is there, right? But I have no idea what the first principle was when I was a little child, right? And Venerable Yinchun said there's a first period of Buddhism is called the first principle Siddhanta. Then the middle period is responsive Siddhanta, which is it is starting to, the text start to expand in responding to the queries or the questions that come up, right? In Chinese, this is Di Si Tan, the first Siddhanta. This is Dui Zi Si Tan, that means responding to whatever that is actually the queries and the questions that are actually there. The third part is virtue. In Chinese, it's Yin Ren Xiang San Si Tan, that means get inspiring a person to go towards virtuous life. That is the third Siddhanta. The fourth Siddhanta is W, worldly Siddhanta, 世间西坛. So it's a bit like this. I'll give you an example. The teachings at the core are the core, right? This is where the Buddha says, these are the principles, this is the practice, this is how you see the world, this is how you practice, so on and so forth. This is when you start to expand. How you practice, then you do this, you might expand a little bit more. The Buddha didn't give a, didn't expand on a lot of the instructions. Some of the instruction commentaries, things like that is responsive. And as it evolved, more and more scriptures get added. You can see, this is the core part of it. More scriptures get added on, and what happens is, the ones that get added on through time in virtuous is like teaching you to do good. The focus is to be a good person. It's not so much as to understand and get awakened and enlightenment, but the focus is be good, right? Do generosity, have precepts, that's the focus. And then as it evolves even further, worldly Siddhanta is dealing with worldly issues like money, relationships, things like that. There is very worldly kind of concerns. That part of Buddhism evolved to incorporate the needs, the demands of the market, which is like me as a little, not even as a little child, when I had to do my HSC equivalent, right? You study hard, you know that you need to study hard. But for insurance, you go to the temple and you take offerings. Because as a person at a very worldly level, that is my challenge, right? As a student, my challenge is I need to study, I need to pass my HSCs so I can get to a good place, right? So what I do is, Buddhism has evolved to include that as part of the practice. Worldly topics, money, challenges, health, sickness, you pray for this, you pray for that, there are even practices that you do in order to supposedly gain good health and so on and so forth. And you can see the difference from one historical Buddha that evolved the different types of Buddha, became more and more Buddhas. Yeah? You see how it actually evolved. And that's why when you actually hit with worldly Siddhanta types of teachings that it seems a bit like the Buddha, but it's not quite first principle, sometimes it's quite far away. The flavor changes and shifts so much. Venerable Yin Chun said that it's like milk added with water and more water and more water. I would say it's like milk added with water with some additives, some sugar, some coloring, some preservative. Some of them are not exactly good for you. But this is what happens over 2,600 years. Right? So that's why if you look at Buddhism from here, it's like, oh, this is the Jostic Buddhism. Yeah? That you ask for stuff, you pray for stuff, you receive blessings and stuff. But it's very different from the first principle, which is you need to see for yourself the truth of suffering. You need to see for yourself the cause of suffering. You need to see for yourself how is it to release yourself from suffering. And you need to walk the path of the Eightfold Path in order to develop your mind to see these realities for what they are. That is the core of the Buddha's teachings here. So, let's bring it all together a little bit. Right, we've gone from here to Southeast Asia to India. Right, we travel back to time 2,600 years and we fast forward and then reverse again. So there's a lot that we actually covered this evening, right? But this is important stuff. Because if you're serious about the Buddha's teachings, no matter where you come in, you might come in from worldly stuff, like I did growing up. Some people might hit some of the scriptures that actually are quite core and like, wow, this is quite a different way of looking at the world, right? No matter what it is, we need to always swim upstream to try to get to what the heart of the Buddha's teaching is, right? And there's a lot of literature there. Just this part itself is probably about 4 or 5 times the size of the Bible. That's my guess, right? Because even the Theravadins, which is 11 times the size of the Bible, right? That's one part of that is the core. So assume that about half of that, if you take away about half of that, that's the core of it. And for those of you who have some background, Samyutta Nikaya is usually the one that is. There are four key Nikayas. There are the long discourses, there are the middle length discourses, and there's the connected discourses. The connected discourses are very short. The Buddha says, arise at a place. Oh, actually, it doesn't even have much background. It just says, the Buddha says in this occasion, this teaching. So all the teachings to do with dependent origination gets linked together. All teachings to do with the six sense spaces get linked together. All teachings to do with the five aggregates get linked together. They are very short scriptures. And you know that they are most probably true because they are short. And that's the nature of teaching. A teacher teaches something, tells you, and that's it. Whereas the long discourses has a lot more floweriness in it. Right? You will say that, oh, before the Buddha taught, this deity came down, that one came down. So it's quite flowery in its language. It still has it in itself, still has the core of it, but it's actually quite embellished. So if you are wanting to understand the scriptures and read a little bit more, a good place to start if you're in the English background is, I would suggest go with the middle length discourses. Not too much has been embellished, but they're still a bit easier to read. Connected discourses can be a bit dry. But if you really want to see what's the heart of it, connected discourses is the way to go. But you can see that from that point onwards, it expanded so much. But it is when, at the core of it, when you look at what the Buddha wanted us to do, out of all his compassion, he could not tell us what the durian tastes like. Right? You get what I mean? He could tell you where to go to source durian. He can tell you how to open the durian. He can tell you which durian looks better. D50, 52, whatever these say. Right? But he cannot tell you what the taste of the durian is. But you need to taste it. But he gives you very good systematic guidance as to how you actually go about that. So when you try to reconcile the two, the heart of it is that you need to practice. And given though we're doing so much time travel, let's travel one more time back to just before the Buddha's death. Remember I said that he was unwell, and then he felt a little bit better, and Ananda said, came to him and said, Buddha, oh, I was a bit worried because you weren't feeling too good. But I knew that you wouldn't go before giving us, if you haven't given us orders about what to do with the monks. And then the Buddha said, no, there's no need for that. I've already taught you everything I have. I don't hold anything in my fist. There's no inside or outside teaching. Everything is open. You know everything that I can possibly give to you. It's not up to you. And then he said, be an island unto yourself and take yourself as the refuge. As the Dharma is an island, use the Dharma as a refuge. Then he did expand one more section. This is the important part. You want to know what that is?
Yep.
Therefore, Ananda, you should live as islands unto yourself, being your own refuge with no one else as your refuge. With the Dharma as an island, with the Dharma as your refuge, with no other refuge. That part you already given, yeah? And how does a monk live as an island unto himself, with no other as refuge? So he did expand a little bit more. Right? Then he says, here, Ananda, a monk, he uses a monk because Ananda is a monk, right? So it says, a monk abides contemplating body as body, earnestly, clearly aware, mindful, and having put away all hankering and fretting for the world, and likewise with regards to feelings, mind, and mind objects. That, Ananda, is how a monk lives as an island unto himself, with no other refuge. And those who now in my time or afterwards live thus, this way, they will become the highest, that means they will achieve the highest liberation if they are desirous of learning, if they want to learn. Let me repeat this again. Therefore, Ananda, you should live as islands unto yourself, being your own refuge, with no one else as your refuge, with the Dhamma as an island, with the Dhamma as your refuge, with no other refuge. And how does a monk live as an island unto himself, with no other refuge? Here, Ananda, a monk abides contemplating body as body, earnestly, clearly aware, mindful, and having put away all hankering and fretting for the world, and likewise with regards to feelings, mind, and mind objects. That, Ananda, is how a monk lives as an island unto himself, with no other refuge. And those who now, in my time, or afterwards live thus, they will become the highest if they are desirous of learning. The four things in there that are important. Contemplating body as the body, clearly, earnestly, right? this is the format. Contemplating the body as body, earnestly, clearly aware, mindful, and having putting away all hankering and fretting for the world, and likewise with regards to feelings, mind, and mind objects. What is this collection of these four? Anyone knows? Have you seen this list of these four things? Where have you seen this?
The aggregates, the five.
Not the aggregates, you're close, but not in that teaching. Aggregates is five.
Yeah, five aggregates.
Yep. Aggregate has a different list. Body, feelings, perception. Mental formations and consciousness. This is the mind and body phenomena. This is our makeup. This is me. Yeah? There's some overlap, but this is slightly different list. Four things. Where is this set of teachings from?
It's a bit fussy, but in Satipatthana Sutta.
That's right. Satipatthana, which is translated as the four foundations or four applications of mindfulness. Sati means mindfulness. Patthana, I can't remember the actual root word. But patthana is, I have to go back to my Pali, but it has two meanings. One is the base of it. The other one is how you go along, the application of it. So it can be translated as the four foundations of mindfulness or the four applications of mindfulness. That means you need to train your mind to watch your body, watch your feelings, watch the mind, watch the mental objects. This is how you develop mindfulness. Satipatthana, the foundations or the application of mindfulness through observing these four aspects of experience. And when one is able to earnestly, clearly aware, mindful. Attapi, sampajana, satima. These three things typically come together. Attapi means earnestly. Right? Comes from the root word api, which is heat. That means it is true vigor. Attapi, sampajana, clearly seeing for what it is. Satima, sati is mindfulness. Those three things combined. Attapi, sampajana, satima. Right? And then, having put away all hankering and fretting for the world, that means you are not too much involved in the worldly life, but you are able to direct your mind into these four aspects of experience, that is where wisdom will arise. And then he went on to say, that is how a monk lives as an island unto himself, with no other refuge. And those who, in my time and afterwards, live this way, which is earnestly contemplating, clearly aware, seeing, mindfully, without fretting and hankering for the world, then one is able, they will become the highest if they are desirous of learning. That's the part. If they are wanting to learn. So it depends on the individual still. It is there. I have been teaching for 40 over years in terms of how you apply. This is in fact the basic, most important part of Buddhist meditation. Graham White will cover that next week. Right, we are plugged for next week. Body, feelings, mind objects. These are the four foundations of mindfulness, which is the heart of Buddhist meditation. It is being able to observe the realities of the body and mind phenomena. When you're able to do that, wisdom arises. You start to see, what is this me? How does phenomena arise? Where does craving start? What is it that leads to purity, to goodness, to liberation? What is it that leads to suffering, pain, lamentation? It is through being able to watch our mind and body phenomena. So he was very clear. Right? The how do you actually live as an island unto yourself? Be a lamp unto yourself, whichever translation you go with. Therefore, Ananda, you should live as islands unto yourself, being your own refuge, with no one else as your refuge. With the Dharma as an island, with the Dharma as your refuge, with no other refuge. And how does a monk live as an island unto himself, with no other refuge? Here, Ananda, a monk abides contemplating the body as body, earnestly, clearly aware, mindful, and having put away all hankering and fretting for the world, and likewise with regards to feelings, mind objects. That, Ananda, is how a monk lives as an island unto himself with no other refuge. And those who now in my time and afterwards live thus, they will become the highest if they are desirous of learning.
Highest.
Yes, highest. That means there is the highest state based on his teaching. That means enlightenment. And when you're able to do that, that becomes your refuge, which is the wisdom factor that's actually there. And you can see how far this is from that Jostic Buddhist of mine back then, which I was asking for without understanding what the teacher was teaching. I was going to the teacher to ask for something that he cannot give, really. Right? But that led me here today. So maybe it is okay too. Right? But the thing is, that's where the differences in the contradiction. When you really look at the heart of it, it is, the Buddha says, you need to see for yourself. This is like you need to taste the durian for yourself. And this is how you go and buy the durian, and this is how you open it. The taste of liberation. Any questions? Yes.
I want to go back to your beginning of your talk.
Yes.
You said that you went to Burmese Theravada temples.
Yes.
And also to Mahayana temples. Mm-hmm. So where do you sit now in this whole conglomerate up there? Do you have more Theravada, more Mahayana?
I try to be here. Else? And to be honest, the more that I practice, the more humble I am. Because I know that even the best is that the Buddha is not with us. We can only best find the core of it. I used to be like, oh yeah, this is all wrong, we shouldn't do all that, oh. Right? But in the end, it's that certain humility. Also, based on this, this is my practice. That's why the Buddhist tradition that I'm in is the insight and mindfulness traditions, which is the practice of the Satipatthana. In Chinese Buddhism, we have this set of four as well. Right? In Pali, it's Satipatthana. In Chinese, it is Si Sen. No. What is it, actually? Anyone knows?
I was going to ask.
Si Nian Chu. Right? The four, Si Nian, mindfulness, Chu is spot. The four spots of mindfulness. So you know that you've got scriptures from both sides. You can't go wrong. Well, technically, you can, right? To be fair, that's the humility. But that's the best we have. And the more that I practice, that comes back to that. So which is the pre-split time of the Theravada Mahayana. And that's my practice right now. Maybe in 10 years' time, as I've developed further, it might change. But that's where I am right now. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Others, yes?
What's the correlation before between psychologists and Buddhists that you of? You are the psychologist, obviously?
Yes, yes.
Psychiatrist.
I'm a psychologist, not a psychiatrist.
Okay.
Yep.
Are you going to study your PhD, or you finished your PhD already?
Yeah, I'm practicing as a psychologist right now.
So what I'm trying to ask you is, if you are in, you're put into the final talk between you and the professors, would you try to convince them with both your psychologist professional knowledge and also the Buddha? If you mention Buddha, do you think they will pass you?
I think it depends on what that you mention. For one, I am right now the one who is examining, so I don't need to do that. So that's good. Secondly, it's different. They work at different areas, but there's more and more interaction between the two now. But the Dalai Lama is having yearly meetings with neuroscientists to work out things. So I think right now it depends on what you bring forward. But right now, over the last 15 years, we've been studying psychology, we've been studying the practice of observing mind, feelings, mind and mental objects, and what are the effects of it from a scientific perspective. In fact, that was one of my theses as well, which is looking at the effects of that with anxiety. How does it shift? Now, we are not to the point of measuring this versus enlightenment, because we don't know how to measure that yet. We're not there yet. So there's some interface that's starting to happen, but they still work in different areas.
Different areas?
Yeah. They are related, but they're still approaching it slightly differently. Because the Buddhist path is about your direct experience with it. Psychology as a science looks at patterns of behaviors. So if you put 50 people through a practice of Buddhist meditation, what happens? That is a question you can ask. Right? And then you run your experiment and see what happens. You check their heart rate, you check their stress levels before and after. And there are a lot of studies like that over the last 15 years. Right? So that is where the interaction is right now. It's starting to, over the last 10 years, a lot to do with, to be fair, the Tibetan Buddhists have done a lot of that. Especially the Dalai Lama has done a lot of that dialogue with top neuroscientists of the world, neuropsychiatrists, people like that, right? To study the mind and understanding of what is this constitutes the mind and what actually occurs and happens. There's a lot of interaction that way. Does that answer your question?
I know there's lots of medication that you can put a man who is in a very irritated status
yep.
down right away, make them calm.
Yep. And?
And we can teach him to meditate.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right.
And obviously that medication is quicker and more efficient.
Yeah. So sometimes you need medication, sometimes you need training of the mind. As a psychologist, I don't do medication. I'm not allowed to. It's not my license, but my license is psychological therapies, which is mind training. If I came to you this evening as a psychologist and the title is slightly different, you might get a different angle. But today's topic is very much the heart of the Buddha's teaching. That's why I went to the historical part of it. Came to you more as a Buddhist in this sense. But you're right. The training part, what we're starting to find is that the Buddhist training of the mind that has been passed down from centuries over centuries has been found to be useful with things like anxiety, stress levels, even changes in things like stress hormones and things like that, which is really fascinating. It's an emerging area. Other questions? Yes.
Well, firstly, thank you for the lecture. It's really fascinating and there's a lot to reflect on here.
Yeah.
But I also find it slightly disturbing or we don't seem you and Jim sort of inhabit this area in the middle. We have lots of people along here to do Dharma talks and they seem to be floating around on the outside. Do you think these people are lost or deluded or ignorant?
Well, to be fair, I think we are all deluded.
Well,
so to that,
yes.
Right, but we try to work towards that.
So why aren't these people agreeing with you and Jim?
Well, I think we do agree. It's just that it depends on which angle you get them to talk about. Right? Some agree more or less. Right? But I think we're all working towards that. And in fact, Unibuds has pretty good teachers.
Yeah, they often come along with this supernatural stuff.
Yeah, they can. Because sometimes they're used to functioning and operating out there. But see whether they can bring you in. There's a saying in Buddhism, which is a Chinese saying, in fact, in Chinese Buddhism. I'll say it in Chinese, I'll translate it. 先于欲勾牵后令入佛子. Anyone cares to translate that?
Is that like first you sort of bribe them in and lure them in, and then after that you give them the
right? Yeah, so the translation is use their cravings to hook them in, and then allow them to enter the wisdom of the Buddha, right?
So
now, yes, it can be a hook, depending on the society you're in. Now, if I'm teaching in some different places whereby it's maybe this is not what they're used to, you need to give them certain things to then allow them to come in. To be fair, sometimes the traditions have also evolved such that the hook has become the teaching, and that's the problem. And as Buddhists, that is, I think, something that's important for us to be reflective about. That we need to constantly swim upstream, which is trying to get to the heart of it. It's not about our loyalty to tradition. The respect for tradition is always there. That's really important. No matter who they are, whether they are monks or nuns, if they have given up their life to study and train, it depends on which teachers they come across. I respect them for that vow. But sometimes what they get trained in could be further up or more central. That is what I've seen, in an honest opinion, over the years moving in Buddhist circles across different areas. So there is that issue too. So some teachers, they come in, it might be trying to use a hook, or maybe that in that tradition, the hook has unfortunately become also the teacher. And that, I think, is a big problem. But I can't speak for the other teachers, but you will come across, if you're actually learning more and more, you start to see the convergence that starts to happen. So, no straight answers for that one.
Yeah, I'm really trying to focus
it. I have a very serious suggestion to make. If the Buddha Society of Buddhist Work can consider this, make this lecturer the first ever lecturer for English Buddha talk. And then the rest is just doesn't matter who. I do recommend your talk, sir. I mean, honestly, I've listened to so many talks.
Thank you.
You should be the first made lecturer for the whole semester.
Yeah,
you should be the first one.
I used to be the first talk, actually. Because this is important. You're right. It's actually tricky. And to be honest, I say the humility is there that we still don't know. The scholars will still come back and say that actually we now, because they've also recently found more scriptures, more collections that then say that, well, hang on, there's one collection that has this. So then it adds to that too, the overlapping. Or there's some other that's totally far out. Is it that it doesn't reconcile or what? I think that is the humility as Buddhists that we need to have as well. We work in the best that we can to trace back to the heart of the teachings. And follow the Buddha's words. My advice is, read scriptures. Go and learn to read scriptures directly. Because even many traditions, even within the Theravadan traditions, the focus sometimes has been too much on the commentaries and not the scriptures. And that is also a problem. In some Buddhist countries, if you ask the monks, there is the scriptures, which is, we know that these are the recording of the Buddha's words, and there are what we call commentaries, which are theses that have been written by usually very highly respected monks over the course of the centuries that expand on the scriptures. Yeah? So these are called commentaries. And then we have what we call the sub-commentaries. That means the commentaries that's written about the commentary about the scripture. Yeah? Now, some Buddhist teachers will actually tell you outright that if there's a contradiction between the scripture and the commentary, follow the commentary. But you're like, how can that be? Right? Because the commentary is sectarian. So sometimes there's a certain loyalty, I think. And again, I say this with respect. Right? But as Buddhists, we need to actually try to read the scriptures for ourselves. And engage in this type of discussion and understanding of trying to work out what is actually occurring. That's why I say Buddhist exhibition is a very great, good thing for you to learn, because you suddenly see, wow, there's so many different types of Buddha statues. There's the historical Buddha, and there's this Buddha, and that Buddha. It's like, whoa, right? What's actually happening? Then you trace back, oh, historically this happened, it spread to different areas, and that makes you think, as it spread, what actually happens? How do you then assimilate? In the process of assimilation of Buddhism, what actually occurred in there? Tibetan Buddhism looks very different from a Thai Buddhist, right? But they can share similarities. The similarities is where that's the heart of it. So in some ways, I agree with you, it can be very disturbing too. And it was a bit like this for me when I first embarked on this process, right? And it was also for me very confusing. But I started to make sense more and more and clarify and sharpen. And then sometimes in the process of sharpening, you're like, yes, I think I got it. And then new evidence emerges and you're like, well, hang on. So after a while, you have certain humility that comes up, and then you try your best to work with whatever there is there. And it comes down to this. No teacher, no good Buddhist teacher can tell you that observing your mind and body processes is wrong. Because that is where wisdom arises.
What you're saying really applies to anybody, but it applies to Christianity equally.
Which
so
part? The scripture.
You've got Protestants and you've got Catholics. Yep. You've got Catholics traditionally, and then there's the Protestants, and there's the Evangelicals, and you've got the Happy Clappers, and everyone else. You know, and then
right.
Islam's the same. You've got the Sunnis and the
yep.
Shiites, and then it goes down.
That's right. Yep. And if you look at scriptural evolution, it's the same thing has happened to the Bible. If you look at the book of Mark and book of Luke, even the whole account of the resurrection is quite significantly different, right? The original version of Mark without the further addition of the last part. In fact, I was just discussing this with someone yesterday. it doesn't say that the Jesus appeared and so on and so forth in flesh. You read Mark is that a person appeared to tell them that he has arisen and he will be where you something like where he said he will be, and then they all went their separate ways, and that was the end of the book. Whereas the book of Luke said that then they went in and saw this, and he appeared in a certain angel came, he appeared in a certain form. But what is the heart of it? So that actually happens across. Yeah. And in fact, it is thank you to those scholars who do not have a particular alliance to any traditions. Those are the ones who are most believable. You know what I mean? They are just scholars of religious studies that have an understanding of comparing religion, comparing scriptures. They are the ones that have contributed a lot in our understanding of Buddhism these days, which comes back to this chunk here. And I agree with you, it happens in all traditions, because that's just the nature of it. Anything that goes with a few thousand years, 300, few thousand years, things are bound to shift. So for us, we are respectful, we are humble, but at the same time, we are also critical. And I think that's an important balance. And when there are contradictions, then go back to the scriptures, see what the different angles say. And then from there, see if we can triangulate, what we call triangulation in science. If you've got different data sets, let's see whether we can triangulate into what the core of it is. And maybe we will never get to the core, but we can get to as close as possible to the core. So be a light unto yourself, be an island unto yourself, be a lamp unto yourself, but know how to do that. I better end now. All right, thank you everyone.